We're on the sidewalk on 51st Street between Brookside Boulevard and Oak. On this busy retail block, a coffee shop and a few small restaurants are currently barricaded off by a plywood wall. With a Whole Foods and some apartment buildings going in across the street, the wall is here to protect pedestrians from construction-related debris. But the wall's about 8 feet high, tall enough to keep people on the street from seeing in. It also keeps everyone on the sidewalk and in the restaurants from seeing out.
We're going to be staring at this wall for probably, you know, 2-3 months.
That's Zach Moores, owner of Crow's Coffee. He talked to other business owners and some patrons to see if anyone had a good idea about what to do with this wall.
I mean, of course, everybody was art, art, art. What can we do to get art up here?
Zach got local artists on board to work on a mural. One of the artists who's gotten involved is DJ Burton. He spends a lot of time in coffee shops working in sketchbooks, but this is his first full-sized mural.
Somebody's in the process of walking to get coffee or walking to go, you know, to eat, and you're painting a picture, and all of a sudden they're stopped in their tracks, and it's like, whoa, what is this? Why are you doing this? What is this for? I don't know what it is, but I love it. Thank you for doing this. And that interaction is the most important to me because, it, you know, art is about creating.
The mural's still in progress. There's even a large space reserved for people to add their own work.
It's really kind of transformed from something negative to something really, really positive. And this wall will come down at some point, but all this art is going to kind of be repurposed throughout this project.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's show on KCUR's Central Standard is all about taking these kinds of moments in our communities, whether we're talking about a single block or an entire town, and transforming them through art. We'll be hearing from a Kansas City muralist later in the show, but I want to start by introducing Kansas artists Dave Lowenstein and Amber Hansen. Dave is a muralist who has spearheaded public art projects in lots of small towns, not just in Kansas, but throughout the Midwest. Amber worked with him on some of those projects, and she's the co-creator of a beautiful documentary that follows the intimate stories of how those murals came to be. The movie is Called to Walls, and it's screening at KU this evening. Amber, good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me here.
Thank you for being here. And Dave Lowenstein, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you, Gina.
So I wonder, Dave and Amber, I'll start with you, Dave. If what we just heard about transforming a kind of a rotten situation into something positive, if that resonates with you in terms of creating murals in small towns, many of which are in economic decline.
Yeah, I think that's one of the sort of commonly understood ways that murals come into being is in a remedial sort of sense. And I think that's okay. I mean, in some situations, that's the right solution. What I'm more interested in myself is doing these projects in a more progressive and positive way, where we're bringing people together to think about and talk about the things that matter to them most, and then facilitating a way for them to act on those concerns and aspirations and challenges, in this case, through a mural. So it's not necessarily remedial. It's something that's seen in a very positive light, not something to fix up an abandoned building necessarily, but to highlight the democratic and civic nature of people.
Amber, is that how you see it too?
Yeah, I mean, and it's something that I've come to learn more about through working with Dave and being introduced to the Mid-America Mural Project, which the film features. But yeah, that you can approach these projects as an opportunity to bring people together to make something new and to have conversations about the place where they live in a progressive way, you know, not reacting to something else that's happening to the community, but as a way of starting to take a step forward in a way of shaping the community in a proactive way.
Dave, first of all, define a mural for me. I have a feeling there's more to your definition than paint on a wall.
Wow. Yeah, I don't think about that anymore, the definition of a mural. I don't think the medium is that important. For me, I guess it means in the public realm, site-specific. And I guess the only other thing that I'd add to my definition, and this varies from others, Hector might have something to say about this later.
And Hector is the Kansas City muralist we'll be speaking with later in the show.
Right. Is that ours are all made on site. So we are not just creating the design and having conversations with folks about these projects, but we're also performing them to a certain extent at the place where they're happening, which creates a kind of improvised gathering space and sort of like a Hyde Park speaker's corner for a while the murals are going up.
Yeah, there's quite a process, and I want to get into your process shortly, but can you first give us a little history of Murals 101? I mean, what's the American tradition you're working from when you take on a mural project?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I'll give you one quick version of that. For me and my peers, we're sort of known as the community-based muralists. There's a mural movement in this country that began in the late 1960s. It came out of really the civil rights movement, started in Chicago with a mural known as the Wall of Respect. It was a community-based project where artists and neighbors came together to represent really their heroes in this African-American neighborhood in Chicago. That group of artists and that movement was inspired in part by the WPA project and the mural project that was part of the WPA in the 1930s. We see these murals all across the United States in schools and post offices and other public buildings. And they were meant to inspire people during hard times in the U.S. after the Depression. Those folks from the WPA were inspired by the great Mexican muralists who were working after the revolution in Mexico in the 20s through the 40s. We're talking about Diego Rivera and David Siqueiros and Jose Clemente Orozco. So the contemporary murals that we see today have a really rooted and a wonderful tradition in this country.
How did you first get into making public art? What drew you to it?
Yeah, well, it's a circuitous route. I was in grad school at the University of Kansas. I was actually a landscape painter at the time and enjoyed that quite a bit, but sort of lost the thread for what happened to my art, my paintings, after they got out of the studio. I wasn't so thrilled by the gallery scene. And so I was asked to do a mural for a bar in downtown Lawrence and thought it was a really interesting proposition. I had no idea how to do it. This is in 1991, but took it on as a challenge and found right away that I was just entranced by this notion, because all of a sudden the audience for the artwork was no longer just folks who showed up at a gallery opening, but it was anybody and everybody on the street, all the passersby. And they weren't hesitant about telling me what they thought. And not only that, oftentimes folks would offer their help, and these projects became something much more than I'd ever realized as sort of an individual artist in my studio, and I got the bug.
Tell me about the project that Amber and her collaborator ended up documenting for this movie called To Walls.
Yeah, well, this is a fantastic project. This is a documentary about the Mid-America Mural Project. It was a project supported by the Mid-America Arts Alliance based here in Kansas City. We ran a project that did one mural in each of their six state region from 2010 to 2013. And this was meant as a project that would model or pilot this deep community-based process of working on public art with communities that either didn't have access to or the opportunity to start a project like this on their own. And so we visit places from Tonkawa, Oklahoma to Joplin, Missouri, soon after the tornado struck there, to places like Arkadelphia, Arkansas, in the foothills of the Ouachita Mountains. And each place, the process, the sort of infrastructure of the project is similar, but the results are widely different and pretty interesting, I think.
Amber, how did you get involved?
Well, my partner Nicholas Ward and I had just finished a mural. We're both muralists as well, in Junction City, Kansas. And Dave was writing a book about chronicling all the murals in Kansas. And after he had seen this mural, he contacted us because he was looking for mural assistants to join him in the first of these projects in Tonkawa, Oklahoma. So at the time, Nicholas and I had just finished graduate school at the University of Kansas for degrees in painting. And we joined Dave on this project. And we really didn't know what to expect. You know, we had made murals, but we hadn't made work that engaged with the community. And after being a part of this project, we quickly realized that after all of our years studying art in an academic way, we hadn't been introduced to this type of process, and that compelled us to want to tell this story, and we realized that it was an important one to share.
Tell me about the process you're describing. What was unique about it from your perspective?
Well, first of all, the type of engagement that takes place in these projects is truly authentic, and it begins at the very beginning of the process. First of all, we're invited to the communities to make these projects there. So they want this project to happen in these particular places. But starting right from the beginning of the design and the initial discussions about, you know, the topics and the themes and the ideas that are going to be included in the mural, we are engaging with members of that place. And it takes place over a course of 3 months. So throughout this entire time, we're living in that place. We're becoming invested in the stories and the histories and the people who live there. So I guess it was much more involved than I previously had thought, you know, these types of projects are.
You know, I'm curious to know a little bit more about your own artistic background. Your name sounded familiar to me, and I finally figured out why. Like me, some people may remember you from a chicken scandal a few years back at the Spencer Museum in Lawrence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and that project was inspired by taking, you know, working with communities in the murals. It did inspire me to, you know, take a question or idea and ask that question publicly, and to invite community members to be a part of a conversation and ideas that I felt really and I still feel very strongly about. So
can you just quickly remind us of what you did and how the community responded?
Yeah, that project was designed to offer the community an experience of growing and raising chickens within a public space where they would be cared for by the local community. And throughout that time, people would have a chance to interact with the chickens and have the experience of raising them. And at the end of the project, we would butcher and slaughter the chickens and eat them and share them in a meal. And so this project, before it even began, there was a lot of conversation and pushback about the project. And we eventually, because of city codes, there's a code that states that you can legally raise chickens for meat and feather and egg consumption, but you cannot lawfully harm a domesticated animal. So, you know, at that point, we chose...
So that the chickens had become domesticated animals because of the process.
Right. So at that point, we chose to change the project to include voices who opposed, you know, the original project, and to invite those types of conversations. And the project ended up that there was a coop, an empty coop that traveled throughout Lawrence, and it ended with a meal that people brought food to. And I invite speakers from various different perspectives to speak on their experience interacting with chickens and their relationship with the food they eat.
So the project became the conversation. Is it important to you as an artist to somehow engage, and maybe even in a provocative way, a larger community to make sure a conversation happens?
I think it's important for artists to ask difficult questions. And a lot of times when working with communities, you don't know how it's going to play out. And a lot of times you are put in a very vulnerable place at times. And but I think it's important that we're asking those questions and that we're asking hard questions and we're bringing those conversations into a public realm.
What were some of the hard questions that you found yourself asking as part of this Mid-America Mural project?
Well, there are, I mean, in terms of the film, in creating the film, some of the questions that and decisions we had to make was, who would represent these stories in the documentary? And initially when we would, arrive to that town, we'd start looking for different people who we thought might be, who either could tell stories really well or we thought would, be an interesting person to include in the film. But oftentimes that would change because, a person who you maybe didn't think would be quite as involved in the project all of a sudden becomes really excited and engaged, and they become a larger character in the project, and then therefore become a more prominent role in the film.
That's the democratic nature of the process. The movie follows projects in Tonkawa, Oklahoma, Newton, Kansas, Joplin, Missouri, right after the tornado, and Arkadelphia, Arkansas. And Dave, we're going to talk about other projects a little later, but I was deeply moved by this story about Joplin. You'd set up a project in Joplin before the tornado devastated that town, but you didn't show up to actually begin the project until after the tornado. How did that change things for you?
Yeah, right. So this really put this process to the test. The first thing that happened after we heard about the tornado, and all of us, of course, were watching in that moment because the weather was crazy everywhere, and all of us had friends or friends of friends who were in Joplin. First thing is find out if people we know are okay. And then a week or so later, we were invited down to have a discussion about this project. And the question, one of the hard questions at that moment for the project was, why do it at all? What's the purpose and the point of doing a mural in light of this devastation with people recovering in the hospital, with funerals happening?
With so many buildings not even standing.
And so we had a public meeting where city officials and artists and families and others came together to just talk about it. And I put that question to the group. I said, should we be doing this at all? Is it important? And it was sort of overwhelming because just about to a person in this big room full of people, they said it's more important now than it was before. And what I recall folks saying is that this kind of project now is exactly what we need, because we want to reflect and represent what we've lost. We want to acknowledge the incredible effort people are making to help in this moment. And we want to envision a future for the community. That was the beginning of the project in Joplin.
Well, you worked with kids on an art project that ended up forming the basis for the mural, although you didn't know that when you started that art project necessarily. I want to hear a little bit of you working with the kids in Joplin. We're going to hear a clip from the film called To Walls.
Do you think tigers dream?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you think frogs dream?
Yeah.
Do you think plants dream?
No.
All right, so here's what I'm thinking about. What if all of the tigers and all of the frogs and all of the plants and all of the people and all of the other animals and buildings and bicycles here in Joplin had a dream together? Okay. What would that dream be if it was dreaming about how it wanted to be in the future? What would the dream of Joplin
be? To be fixed.
Okay, well, what we're gonna do is, instead of talk about it, we're gonna draw it.
So that last line was, instead of talking about it, we're gonna draw it. Tell me what the kids drew.
Yeah, so this was really an interesting moment. In that room, which I think was maybe a Boys and Girls Club group at the Spiva Art Center, we had no idea initially which of those kids had experienced what. And there were thousands of children who were displaced at that moment. They weren't, you know, where they would normally be with their families or in summer programs. So we felt it really important not to ask them to draw about the tornado. So we didn't. You heard the prompt that I gave. And what was really amazing is when they set to work in groups of three on their drawings, they made those drawings that I suggested about their dreams and their friends and their families. But they also made drawings about the storm. And my sense is they did it because it was what was in their hearts and in their minds at the time. And kids, unlike us, don't self-censor. They say and do what they feel. And so what came of those drawing sessions were this remarkable account of their experiences during and after the tornado. And they became a centerpiece directly in the design of the mural.
Yeah, I mean, you hung their drawings in an abandoned building for a one-night exhibition in Joplin, and it was as you were hanging the art that it seemed you saw that the kids had created images that could work on a wall. Talk to me about what you saw that and how you saw that this could be transformed into some sort of centerpiece for the mural.
Yeah, well, it's not unusual. I mean, our process, which Amber was talking about, always involves the work of those folks who decide to come and be part of our design teams. We're always incorporating the ideas or the drawings of others. But the thing we were struggling most with in Joplin was, how do you represent this moment of the storm coming through and the devastation and the recovery and all of the volunteers? And it didn't feel right for me or other outside artists to try to depict this. It didn't make sense to try to describe it in a realistic way. And then, you know, it wasn't just me. It was other folks who were working on this project just realized, oh my gosh, these kids have done it.
There was a lot of debate in the town about whether the mural should show the tornado or not. Let's hear a couple of voices on this. Another clip from Called to Walls.
I was initially among those people who thought including tornado imagery in the design was not a really good idea. I didn't want that to be what Joplin was known for or remembered for. I didn't want those images to be a constant reminder of what we'd been through. It was a tough time, and I, for one, initially started out not wanting to see any of that.
It was, well, and it's going to be an unpleasant memory for a long time. So it's kind of like in our community meetings, we knew, you know, I kept saying it wasn't going to be a tornado wall. And there was pressure not to have a tornado wall, especially where it was going to be located, which was downtown, near downtown. And as things transpired, you just couldn't get the tornado and, you know, the images that went along with that out of your mind.
How did the conversations unfold around this? I mean, because there was also this issue of city officials wanting something very different than the rest of the group wanted. The city seemed to want the mural to be what they called flypaper, attracting people to the city. And they wanted it to be this sort of hearkening back to the glory days of old Joplin. How did you deal with all of this tension to depict the tornado, to not depict the tornado? Mural for the purpose of healing and rebuilding versus a mural for the purpose of flypaper.
Yeah, there's a real critical moment in the film that shows one of these meetings we had where a city official comes in and basically tells us, all of these folks who are volunteering on this project and the visiting artists, that this mural should be, you know, about Route 66 and history, and we should stick to that, and anything dealing with the tornado, a memorial or whatever, will be handled by others. And this is where you're really tested as a facilitator, lead artist on these projects, because it was not for me to decide. And what I recall happening in that moment was relying on the folks who had chosen to be part of our project and saying to them, you know, listen, you're the ones working on this mural, and it's up to you what you want it to be about. We will deal with any conflicts or conversations we have to have with the city, but I don't want you to be intimidated or turned towards something that you don't want to depict. And that is at the heart and soul of what these projects are about. It's a civic process that we're trying to sort of jumpstart, where folks can have these difficult conversations and then act on them in a really powerful way. In this case, it's a mural. But as I said before, in future situations, there may be another issue that they're dealing with at City Hall or in some other context where they use the same skills.
The city owned the wall you were there to paint. So this points to one of the big questions about murals. Unlike an artist who works on a canvas, you work on a material that doesn't belong to you. How does that affect creative freedom? And can it cause other kinds of logistical nightmares beyond the kind we just heard?
Yeah, there are lots of logistical nightmares. And I think these are the important challenges for us to engage with. And there's an intention there to do it. Part of the idea here is to ask a difficult question, which is, who controls our visual environment? Whose voices do we see and hear, and whose don't we see and hear? And these projects are meant in a very serious way to create opportunities for those folks who maybe are underrepresented for various reasons to have a voice in our visual environment. I mean, this is work that's inspired by Howard Zinn and Studs Terkel.
Hold that thought. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll get a Kansas City muralist who works in urban areas in on this discussion. If you have a question or story about the role of murals in a community, call 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman with KCUR's Central Standard, and today's show is all about murals, why artists create them, and who they really belong to. We've been hearing from Kansas artists Dave Lowenstein and Amber Hansen. Now let's bring Kansas City's Hector Casanova into the discussion. Hi, Hector.
Hi, Gina.
You've been an artist for a long, long time. Kansas City mostly knows you from your illustrations in the Kansas City Star. You also do comics and paintings, and now murals, too. How did you get into murals?
Well, I've been doing large art, large format paintings, typically more as a live art kind of,
like performance.
Yes, yeah, like a one-night event where I would execute a really large painting in front of a crowd and, you know, anywhere from between an hour and 3 hours. A couple of years ago, I just was having an assessment of my life and work. I'm basically middle-aged, so that's what happens at this time. And it's something that has, for a long time bothered me is just the... because of, you know, being a working illustrator, by necessity, my work has involved the computer. And it gotten to the point where 99% of my work was digital. And it just became something that was really bothering me. There was something just intrinsically unfulfilling about working all the time and not having anything physical to show. All of the images, everything that I've done for years and years was basically just existed only in pixels and in recycling bins. So I made a very conscious decision to move away from working with a computer in my artwork. And that quickly led to just working with paint on larger and larger surfaces. And that's where I am now.
What's your take on this question of ownership when it comes to murals?
I love murals specifically because of the direct link between the artist and the viewing public. The fact that this is art that is not experienced in the rarefied context of an art gallery. People don't have to go out of their way to seek the art, and the art meets them where they live and where they work. And I think I'm a populist at heart, and I very much believe that art is of immense value to the people, and that it's not a luxury item, and it's not this inaccessible thing that you need to be educated to be able to appreciate. I think that it's what makes life beautiful. So that's really why I've gravitated to this, is because it's a way to bypass the art world, really, and go straight to the viewing public.
Is there then, I'm curious about whether there's then another world to bypass when it's not the art world. I mean, one of your projects is the Skerritt Elementary School building, one of many Kansas City school buildings that was boarded and shuttered after a major school consolidation a few years back. I mean, that, it seems like getting permission to paint on the side of a former school building in your neighborhood requires going through another kind of bureaucracy. So tell me about that project, how it unfolded, how you even decided to do it.
I started teaching at the Kansas City Art Institute 2.5 years ago. And from the very beginning, when I started teaching there, I wanted my students to work on a mural project. The reason for wanting to get into murals is because really probably my favorite thing about teaching is that I am only one person, but by being in this position of being an instructor, all of a sudden I had an army. And that's really how I approached it. I can only accomplish so much, and I really do see art as a tool for progress and for social change, but I can only do so much. And now all of a sudden I had 60 extra arms. So I wanted to have a mural project, something that would be a large scale, ambitious thing, way more ambitious than I could conceivably manage by myself, because now I had manpower, and also as the perfect opportunity to show students that direct link between the artist and the public, and that there's other ways to be an artist, and there's other ways to affect the world without having to go through the gallery route, which is a very difficult and kind of tricky route to navigate. So I started just emailing and calling different agencies through the city, and it was a really tedious, long, and occasionally very hopeless process. And there were a couple false starts. Different departments in the city would become interested until they realized that they would have to put forth some effort or money into making this this project happen. And then we would go back to square one. I just kept I kept at it. One of the things that I try to also teach my students is that really the only secret to making it is to just be unstoppable. And every time that I got disappointed or discouraged, I just weighed all the work that I'd already put into it versus just giving up now. And it's felt like giving up at this point was just wasting everything that I'd already done. So one more push. It was basically every time it was just like one more push. And I eventually got a phone call or an email from the Kansas City Public School System. They called me in for a meeting, and they had this issue with the Skerritt Elementary School that had been shuttered for a few years. And the residents of the area, of the neighborhood, had been complaining about just the vandalism and the graffiti, the tagging, and the loitering. The school had basically become a magnet for just really unpleasant negative activity within the neighborhood. And the school system had been just painting over the graffiti, and it was this kind of like whack-a-mole process where they would paint over the graffiti, and then a few weeks later it would be back, and it was just endless. And they're trying to come up with a different solution. And so the project that I was trying to get started, a large-scale community beautification project, and the needs that they were trying to solve, everything lined up perfectly. So once we managed to hook up, to connect, everything started really working, and all of the frustration and the hours of emails and stuff paid off.
That's awesome. With the needs of the residents and the desires of the residents being such a big part of it, did you feel compelled to get into a dialogue with the community about what they wanted to see on the mural, or was that not a part of the process?
No, it absolutely was a part of the process, and it was very important for me, and for me to let the community and my students understand that we couldn't just kind of like swoop in and slap artwork over this building, something that we would think is very cool, but the community had no input and no say over, because that would feel like a violation. That really is just kind of coming in and having your way with a neighborhood and then just flying away and thinking you saved the day somehow. It was extremely important that the community felt ownership of this project because they live with it. We don't have to live with it. So one of the first steps was to get the word out. We want to do this project and we want the community's input, suggestions for themes, subject matter, ideas, inspiration, anything that they would like to see addressed. We wanted to know about it and we would try to incorporate it or at least take it into consideration as we were coming up with imagery. So we set up a Facebook page and an email account, and I tried to reach out to the community. I went to neighborhood meetings and put in calls for ideas and submissions through the Northeast News newspaper, the local newspaper for the community. So it was important that we had that dialogue open and that it stayed open, that it wasn't just like a one-time affair. It's an ongoing open door for dialogue.
I did a drive-by yesterday to refresh my memory, and there's kind of a beehive motif. What's the beehive motif about?
That was all of the imagery is generated by the students. Even though I've assembled this project and I kind of direct it, I'm very much a captain, but my students are the ones that generate all of the imagery. And all of the imagery is based on the community's input. We got email from the community and a lot of suggestions, and I went through all of the every single suggestion that we've got. I've kind of collated and kind of broke it into the categories for subject matter, and I just kind of made lists. And any term, any kind of word that or theme that I would see coming up, especially things that came up repeatedly, I just kind of broke everything into three categories. And by far the biggest pool of suggestions had to do with community and nonviolence, peace, justice. Very broad, a kind of almost open-ended subject matter. And that was the largest pool. There were other, a couple other themes that came up as repeating, motifs or suggestions. But the community one was the biggest one. This is an illustration project because that's exactly what illustrators do. We take this subject matter and just give it a visual form, and it can be very literal, very linear, or it can be very poetic. So my students came up with a way of addressing the community concept by doing a series of panels that had ants and bees with a honeycomb pattern. So we took that honeycomb hexagons and decided to just keep that as a recurring visual motif. So we're carrying it throughout.
KCUR Central Standard will be right back with this conversation about how art on walls in public transforms communities, urban and rural. I'm Gina Kaufman, back in a minute. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today we're talking about murals with three people who create them. Dave Lowenstein and Amber Hansen have made murals in lots of rural areas, and Hector Casanova's projects are here in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi again, Dave.
Hello.
Amber, welcome back.
Hi, thanks.
Hey, Hector.
Hi, Gina.
So we were just talking about Hector's project in a shuttered school building in the historic Northeast in the Skerritt Renaissance neighborhood. And Hector, there's a panel with it's vertical and it's got like beautiful stuff bursting out of someone's head, which makes me think about the building's original purpose and its history, that education and what's supposed to happen in someone's mind when they learn. And for all of you, I'm really curious about how the history of the places that become your canvases, how that figures in. How did the fact that this used to be a school matter to you, Hector?
I talked about the community's kind of input and breaking it into categories. So, I mentioned one of them was peace and unity and community and so on. There's one about history of the historic Northeast and Kansas City in general, but historic Northeast, with some focus and emphasis on architectural landmarks and just individual buildings that are standing, buildings that are gone. So taking all of this input into account, this gave my students huge pool of material to work with. And some of the imagery, like that one with the, you know, this head with all of this kind of vegetation.
Flowers.
Yeah. It's very lyrical and very beautiful. So we're very conscious of the history of the building itself. And there's also a lot of, not a lot, but there's some of the artwork has more of like a children's book style to it. And again, trying to honor to the history of what, you know, what this building was originally for. So we try to incorporate all of these things, which leads to having so many different themes and subject matters and especially styles. I have so many students that are working on this and trying to, you know, the biggest challenge was to kind of get all of these different voices to kind of merge into a harmonious, you know, kind of chorus.
Yeah, I want to turn to Dave and Amber now. In Tonkawa, Oklahoma, as part of your Mid-America Mural Project, you went to great lengths to be sure that voices in the community were included, particularly Native American voices. Talk to me about how you ended up doing that.
Yeah, well, Tonkawa, the town, is named after Tonkawa, the tribe. And the tribe has a small reservation that's just outside of town. And, you know, like I was saying before, it wasn't my decision or Amber's decision or our decision. This was something that emerged from the group of people from those communities, the tribal community and the town community, that they thought was essential. It also goes back to somebody I mentioned before, Howard Zinn, you know, the writer of A People's History of the United States, where we're trying to surface those stories that are underrepresented or potentially misrepresented. Because if you think about it, in the public realm, there are so few voices of people that we commonly know in our lives represented for us to see and hear. You don't really think about it until you start looking, that mostly what we're seeing is advertising and sloganeering. So in the case of Tonkawa, the story of those people and not just their past, not just that long ago situation with our Native American heritage, but how they still are there today in a very vital way was integral to this project.
Amber, there was also an old guy in the town named Max who became a character in the mural. Who was Max and why did he need to be in it?
Yeah, Max Carr was an individual we met early on. We were invited to a pancake breakfast that was taking place at the church. And
I love this. You had a rule that you went to everything you were invited to.
Yeah, and that way we're participants in this town, and it really gives us an intimate and authentic feel about what it's like to live there, because we are living there for 3 months. And so we'd met Max, and we heard this story that he used to deliver the newspaper to the rural houses in the country by his airplane. So he'd be throwing the newspapers out of his airplane, and we thought that this was a fantastic story. And realized also that a lot of other people in the community had never heard this story before. So it was important for us to, you know, display this unique story on the wall, but also it's a portion of the film as well.
So in the movie, there's this meditation on the aesthetic charm of how worn and faded small towns can be, but that you can't, as much as there's an aesthetic charm to that, you can't help but feel some sadness when it comes to why it's worn down and faded. Talk to me about that predicament for you as a muralist, that there's this opportunity in these structures, but that there's also a sadness in that opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of one of the considerations of being an outsider on projects like this, which I think for any artists who choose to do this or who are doing it, you know very well that you must rely on the folks who live in these places to guide you into how these projects should take shape. Because my initial perception in some of these places is of a kind of nostalgia for a time that was, and a beauty in the worn surfaces of buildings, but they also represent, in many cases, an economy that's in trouble, or a loss of population in those places. And it's really important to be aware of your own perceptions as you come to engage with people and their heritage and their challenges and aspirations, and try to help them represent themselves in that moment.
Tonkawa in particular, there's a moment in the film where someone says, you know, people had given up on this place. Is that part of what you were dealing with in the community work you did there, just a sense of a place that people had given up on?
Yeah, you know, we heard that, but that's sort of the story you might assume going to visit there from a place like Kansas City. But the reality is much more complex, because there were lots and lots of people who were in love with Tonkawa still. They raised their families there. They work there. They have incredible pride in the place as well. And so for me as an artist in that moment, it was to not get stuck with my initial perception of the loss, but to understand that folks still really love this place and have great pride in it.
What do you know about the future of your murals when you create them? I mean, again, we come back to this idea that the murals belong to entire communities, and you have, you know, you it seems you try very hard not to take too much ownership of them as a creator, but that the buildings themselves do belong to someone, and long term, you can't know what's going to happen. And in fact, you've encountered that very thing with pollinators in Lawrence, which was at the farmer's market.
Yeah, right. So as you mentioned before, Gina, you know, we're working in an interesting way, because these aren't like sculptures that are sited in public and have their own place. We're working in collaboration with folks who own buildings and ownership changes. But these projects, what they do in a wonderful way is they begin relationships. They begin relationships between artists and folks who live in these communities. They begin relationships between city administrators and those of us who are trying to make these projects happen, and the owners of the buildings. And, you know, that could be considered a burden to some artists, because it means you have accountability over a long period of time. And believe me, I know, because I'm restoring murals now that I did 20 and 25 years ago. But I see it as a wonderful thing. I get to go back to these places and understand and hear the stories from people who were children at the time that these things were being made, and how they've impacted their lives and what they mean to them, and how the imagery maybe is not exactly what I intended at the moment, but has shaped a new story for them. So I see them as introductions and the beginning of long-term relationships.
Hector, someday down the road, if the elementary school building takes on a new life, and in its new life, the mural that you and your students have created no longer makes practical sense there for whatever reason, how does that possibility affect you? Do you have to just keep a loose grip on this stuff?
You know, we moved forward with this from the very beginning, knowing that the future of the building was uncertain. And, you know, the murals could be there from, you know, 6 months to 15 years. We have no way of knowing. And we understand that, you know, the intent of the project is to enrich a community, to take what was an eyesore and turn it into a source of pride, into a visual landmark. So the hope, and we've kind of agreed as to have an understanding with the Kansas City Public School System, that when the time comes for the building to be repurposed for whatever comes next, the hope is to then take the artwork and hopefully move it to a new location where it would be fulfilling that process again. Although, you know, there's of course logistical considerations.
Yeah. Well, so it sounds like it's built into this process. Amber, congratulations on your film. What is there a final takeaway for you as the filmmaker who's told the story of so many of these murals?
Well, I just hope that when people watch the film, that they will be inspired to become engaged in this type of art making. I think it's really important. It can definitely make a difference in many communities. So that'd be it. Thank you.
Amber Hansen, thanks so much. The movie Called to Walls is showing tonight at KU at the Commons in Spooner Hall. You can get more information on KU's website. Dave Lowenstein, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Gina.
And Hector Casanova, thanks for bringing a Kansas City perspective. It's been great talking with you.
Thanks for having me.
You can listen back to this discussion at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Subscribe to our podcast while you're there. Tomorrow, it's a portrait session with a former Haskell student whose life was turned around by the sacred art of whole animal butchery. That's tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. Special thanks to intern Kyle Smith. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.